So hello, welcome to another Pharmacy in Practice webcast, podcast, thingamabob. Very, very, very special guest on today. So Professor Harry McQuillan. Now, Harry is Chief Executive of Community Pharmacy Scotland. He's been at the helm for how many years, Harry?
14. A long 14. Time. 14, 2006, yeah.
14. And I'm gonna pass over to you to how about starting by giving a bit of a potted career history. For those of you that don't know you, there's quite a few people listen and read to Pharmacy in Practice now actually out with Scotland. In fact, most of the viewers and readers are from England. So yeah, it'd be good to get a bit of a background.
Yeah, sure, Jonathan. Thanks for the opportunity to speak to you today. I started in the mid-80s, shall we say. I studied at Heriot Watt University, and do not subscribe to the view that it was my last year that closed that particular school of pharmacy. But then in the late 80s, I did my pre-registration year. I started with Boots. That was in Greenock in the west coast of Scotland. I was at Boots for 15 years in quite a varied career between pre-reg, pharmacist, then into pharmacy manager in terms of actually overall within a pharmacy, within a bigger unit to particular store management. I did that. I did area roles. I then got involved in, would we say, pharmacy politics. So I got interested in APCs and primary care subcommittees, what then happened with the NHS infrastructure and local healthcare cooperatives, as was the time during the 90s. During that kind of work, I did locality group work in Lothian across primary care, representing contractors. That got me interested in other particular roles. And then from Boots in 2003, I moved to be the National Pharmacy Advisor to NHS 24. So really a bit of working out of hours and what it meant in unscheduled care. I was there for about 3 years and then came to the Scottish Pharmaceutical General Council back towards community, which I have to say my heart is always lying in. I believe there's a real role that the community pharmacy in particular can do in looking after people in community and keeping them well at home. So that, would I say, brought me back to my first love. That's not to say that all sectors can't work together and have a role to play in patient care. It's just my own particular leaning is towards the community sector. So I've been in Community Pharmacy Scotland for the last, as I say, 14 years, and it's been quite a journey. It's, I have to say, it's been a great job, because no 2 days are the same. And as things move on and services develop, you're continually challenged. And yeah, that takes me up to where I am at the minute. And as you say, visiting professor at Strathclyde. So yeah, pharmacy practice.
Very good. An illustrious career. I know you've been in Scottish pharmacy politics for a good few years and working with CPS. And to be honest, Harry, the evidence is there in terms of the depth and complexity and quality of activity that happens in the community pharmacy network in Scotland. I don't think many people doubt that, and many people around the world certainly come and check in and look at how it's done here, you know. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the big thing that's been going on is COVID. We can't dodge the COVID conversation. So, I mean, I've really enjoyed your YouTube videos. I mean, I'm doing my driveway at the minute. I don't know whether you've seen, but so I've got driveway how-to videos, and then I've got Harry McQuillan as my suggested feed.
So, no.
How have you been through COVID? I mean, how has it affected you personally? And because you really kind of led from the front through those videos. So
yeah, I think that was a decision made by my exec. You know, they said actually the way to engage with the network at this particular time, I have to say, Adam that works with us and Amanda, Michael behind the scenes, Robbie doing the videos, it was their advice to me and Matt, who then just deliver them, that this is the way to do it. Engage with people about how they're actually feeling at the minute. Because in the early days, that was hard. That was tough for everybody. And I know that sounds, people could see it was maybe easier for us not to be directly patient-facing at the time. But actually, our days started at 8 before the pharmacy network opened, as we dealt with contractor and frontline pharmacist queries to allow them to then serve the public. We then tried to get the assistance ready and what they needed during the day. And then we dealt with more queries at night when people closed the door. Because again, they had questions. They had no time to deal with that particular support that they needed. So we in the initial phase, put in long days, long shifts, but it was necessary, along with everybody else, because I know when some people closed the doors, they were still dealing with piles of scripts. So it became difficult, but I think we were getting the feedback that the videos were helping people to realise that there was other people there that understood. Mm-hmm. We couldn't do it for them, but we understood. And we were trying to put support structures and support materials that would allow, at that time, in a very difficult period, for some things to be made a bit easier.
Mm-hmm.
To advocate for people about PPE, to advocate for, actually, can we close between 9 and 10 to let you get caught up, to let you decide how you're going to do with things, and giving people the authority to make those decisions. So that, that's how it felt for us in the early doors about what we did.
It was a real moment of like a test of professionalism, wasn't it? It was like, you know, I think even the scientists that were giving us advice didn't have really robust, and probably you could argue they still don't have very robust, reliable evidence. So you've got to sort of go on your professional instinct and common sense. So I thought it was quite, I personally thought it was quite a unique moment for that reason.
Yeah, and I think there was an element of the decision was right at the time, Jonathan. And there are some things, yeah, you look back on it, and we've changed position on things as the science and the evidence emerged. And I think that was part of us. We had to say, well, you know, it was okay on Monday. This is Friday. You know, it's no longer relevant. So this is what, to try and keep people moving at the pace that the pandemic was moving at itself. And that, I have to say, our team, certainly behind the scenes, was very good at providing me and Matt with that type of information that allowed us at least to try and communicate that as it was going ahead. But it was interesting times.
Absolutely, very a unique time. So, and following up from that, how do you think? Because you're very close to your network, you know, the hallmark of Scottish Community Pharmacy is how close CPS is to the contractor network, and also therefore, also on the other side, how close you guys are to Scottish Government. I think that. I don't know. I'm only guessing, but I think that those relationships are really a secret to your success. So how do you think the network's feeling? What stage are they at in their sort of crisis, stage?
I think in terms of the crisis stage, Jonathan, I think we're through the crisis. We're now into what's the new normal. Now, I know it's almost become a hackneyed phrase in the last 12 weeks. Because initially it was all hands to the pumps, and now we're at the, so what is remobilisation? What is redesign? What is recovery for the NHS? How does that apply to our network? How does it apply to people at the front line when from this is Thursday, from tomorrow, compulsory to have face coverings? Mm-hmm. So what does that mean on an interaction and an assessment of symptoms for the pharmacy network? So there's things that we're trying to preempt and look at as this could be the norm for the next 3 months. We don't know how long that will be, but we've come through 3 months of rapid change to now we're probably into a 3 month phase of how do we embed this now? Mm-hmm. What does that feel like for our patients that come in through our pharmacies to access care? Because it will be different. And how, you know, I'll say a thing, Jonathan, how do we make sure we don't revert back to what we had? Because actually, during the last 12 weeks, we've come up with some novel activities as a network and as professionals that I wouldn't quite like to lose. So that, you know, we might just need to guard against a tendency to go back to what we were doing in January was what we need to go back to. Maybe what we've been doing should stay. Elements of it.
Mm-hmm. I suppose the obvious question off the back of that is what has changed that you like, or what, because I suppose the context of this question is like pharmacy politics takes generally in old world takes ages, doesn't it? Like access to records and, you know, sharing of data and community farming, that is a corker of an example of something that's just been, you know, we've all been, I think there's a consensus across the board that it makes sense. Pharmacists are professionals. We should have access to that. But it just keeps sort of, for one reason or another, there's saboteurs or there's various reasons why it gets kicked down the road. So what elements or changes have you really enjoyed or welcomed as a result of COVID?
That would be one, Jonathan, straight away, the access to what we do. I think the other thing that's come to the fore is there's been a realisation across many other professions, and particularly I think at government level, just how big an asset the actual network is to the NHS in Scotland. So that we've always said that's their opinion, but I think it's now shared by others. And that's all been because of the resilience, the professionalism of the whole teams in the network. In fact, our colleagues in primary care, the secondary care, as a profession, pharmacy has really stepped up during this. So I would like to keep us there in people's, at the front of people's mind. Now I think that it is there. Mm-hmm. The other thing to reflect on, this is specific for the community pharmacy network, is how incredibly resilient it was, because it was put under real pressure. And anyone that is watching this in any of the home countries will realise that that was a really intense period. And the network creaked and it didn't break. Mm-hmm. So actually where we might the way that the network is distributed, where it's located at the heart of communities, actually stood a real test of intensity and came through it.
I mean, I think folk will always invest for two reasons. One, because they see added value, and the other reason, more negative, is sort of out of fear, you know. And I think that supply chain piece is a really, just a personal view, but I think that's a really important thing to remember when the review of what happened during COVID comes around, because that is a really strong selling point of community pharmacy in my opinion. I mean, let's say worst case scenario, we go completely automatic and everything goes online and it's all internet pharmacies. Well, what happens if the internet goes down? You know, it's such a insurance policy.
Yes, exactly that. It's the balance between resilience and efficiency. You know, and you could have a view that it could be more efficient, but actually you're willing to accept that to give you that resilience, that very insurance policy, the phrase you used there. And I think there's been a realisation that actually, wow, what an asset the network is. And I mentioned in one of the earlier videos when you chatted about them, when I said that community pharmacy for the NHS early in the pandemic was the keystone of the bridge. Had you pulled that keystone away and the network fell, the whole bridge would have come down with it. Because keeping people well at home prevented those going into secondary care to have conditions that their medicines keep control and allow them to stay at home. Had that got out of control, we would have filled the beds that we needed in ICU for COVID patients with, now I hate to use the phrase, routine conditions, but conditions that were normally controlled by medicines. So if the medicine supply had fallen over, we'd have flooded secondary care. So actually the network's role in doing that at that time was absolutely critical and helpful.
Absolutely. So, I mean, that's the negative sell to government, which I'm sure you'll do so well.
Negative sell or positive sell?
It's positive.
It's then how you, for me, that's what a foundation, Jonathan, to build on. That's for me, it's, you hear a phrase I use and maybe some of my staff will be sick of it, but it's about supply is not enough. It's essential, and it's not enough. So what is the added value that our network delivers to that? And it's a lot. We could, you know, I could bore for Scotland on what that is, but we need to get that thinking in about, yes, absolutely essential. What else does it allow you to do? And that's where the care comes in. That's where your clinical skill gets added. And as you said, for me, how you in the community pharmacy sector put your degree to the test.
So that's the insurance policy done, and that's let's say how about this? It's the traditional community pharmacy model that needs to stay. But you know me, Harry, I like the new shiny thing. So mm-hmm. So pharmacy first is definitely the new shiny thing.
Yeah.
I mean, what I suppose the cynical question would be, how is pharmacy first different to the traditional minor ailments service?
Yep. Okay. Then it's bigger than the minor ailment service, Jonathan, in that it's going to initially target, as you aware, I know we expanded the minor ailments, but it treats the whole population. So we are going to advocate that community pharmacy becomes the first port of call for your common clinical conditions and getting initial advice when you're maybe just not feeling quite right. And that's the ensure that the pharmacy network takes the appropriate triage and treatment of our citizens through our pharmacy network. And I think that's right. For the first time, though, if we were being honest, the minor ailment service was tremendous in terms of its treatment, but we didn't really get a baseline about what's the advice level, how many people are we referring into different areas of the system. And for pharmacy first, I really like Mrs. Lee Bogue's phrase, one of our researchers, is the art of pharmacy. And it's A for advice, R for referral, T for treatment. And this is really the heart of it, in that we move much more to a consultation service. So the consultation and the interaction with the patient becomes the key thing in the new NHS Pharmacy First service. And then allow you, maybe not so slickly as we would hope to begin with, but as we work with the PMR suppliers, to record all your instances of advice and advice only, referral where you put someone into a different healthcare professional, and then actually the others where you treat very similar to you did under the minor ailment service. What that then gives is the network and the profession an incredible database of activity that we don't have at the minute. So we have some, but not complete. And this flip to an aspect of consultation with a healthcare professional who's an expert in the use of medicines starts to begin to put us into the area of using our expertise exactly where we need to put it. Mm-hmm. So that's the, in a nutshell for me, about NHS Pharmacy First. And we will, to encourage the network and our frontline teams to engage with that, you should be aware that all of that activity, so advice, referral and treatment, qualifies for how the pharmacy will be remunerated for their activity. So, and each of those, so your advice, referral and treatment carry the same weighting. So if you believe professionally, there's no perverse incentive to supply against giving advice only, because they're weighted the same.
So it's a change of emphasis as much as anything, isn't it? You know, it's another step towards pharmacists delivering pharmaceutical care in the way that Hepler and Strand initially imagined it. And do you think what provision is there for long-term medicine pharmaceutical care in there? And also, Is medication safety high up the agenda on that front? Is that encompassed by Pharmacy First, or is that something that'll come? I know the chronic medication service has kind of gone off the boil, I think it's fair to say. So
yep.
Will that be the second coming? Maybe I'm sort of faffing over this question, but I guess what's your vision for the evolution of Pharmacy First? I know the detail. I think everybody else knows the detail of what's coming, but what I'm keen to know is, what's what's your strategic play here? Why are you doing what you're doing now? And what do you expect, or what do you want to happen in 10 years, Harry? Because that's what I want to know.
Right. So initially, you see the launch of Pharmacy First. What comes online, we'll have two PGDs behind. So as I say, the teams will be aware of this, uncomplicated UTIs and in terms of skin infections or use for impetigo. You could see how a cohort of other conditions could be treated that present routinely in a community pharmacy. And if you're not a prescriber, we'll come back to that, how you then refer to someone else and you know exactly what they need. But actually, it's a prescription-only medicine, so you're going to rely on a patient group direction. So patient group direction, you could see those numbers being expanded to other areas as we go ahead. So we are asking our health board colleagues what they believe that is. I've made contact with another colleague I worked with in A&E to give me some ideas. John at NHS 24, what do you see keep coming through in these calls? What would be appropriate to do? So I could see the conditions, Jonathan, expanding that we can treat through community pharmacy, probably initially through PGDs. That, you asked me, where would I be in 10 years' time? Now, if you could see that you become the first port of call, you're looking to treat, you're relying on PGDs, now I see the place for independent prescribing in the community. You're right, that asks about safety. So we need to have an appropriate program that I'm working on with Ness about what that might look like for the community, how that supports independent prescribing, one in every place that we've got, to take us ahead to a place in a decade that all pharmacies in Scotland are independent prescribing at. Then you're less reliant on PGDs. We can intervene on many more conditions, all governed with a regulator, with your competence as an individual. So it's not about that of restricting it. But you can see, I can see clear in my mind, and I have to say I'm grateful for the board's support. In fact, the board's view in terms of where it came out in its vision 3 years ago with CPS, that it's an area to go in. And that's how I see it, Pharmacy First progressing. So early doors with this, relying on some PGDs, expand those conditions as we go ahead, have the population comfortable with coming to us to use our expertise in medicines and that common clinical condition management to ultimately take us to a place where we can prescribe and intervene. But that builds with your other point about medicines care and review, what CMS could become. All of that builds on a firm foundation of supply and appropriateness, so that you can intervene in a manner as you are acutely using NHS Pharmacy First, and you can intervene on a long-term condition that is requiring repeat medication through your prescribing qualification. So that's what I see as the future, and what I think the shiny new bit you said would be coming, and encourage the network to do that.
It's interesting, because I think that statement around every pharmacist should be a prescriber, I think that was from Prescription for Excellence, wasn't it? I mean, it's aspirational, there's no doubt about that, and we wouldn't want there to be like a divide in the profession, you know, prescriber, non-prescriber, but that said, I do agree with you that there should be a move towards that, and hopefully the investment would follow.
And not to take up all of your time and your questions, John, but can you see that if we have a period whereby we can start early years pharmacists onto some form of foundation program that everyone could buy into, and I have to say again, our board has bought into that, that if that can be established, if people complete foundation, could we establish a rolling program from foundation into a prescribing place? So actually, we're quite upfront with you. If you're going to work in the community, we need you to be a prescriber. Now, as that rolls ahead, there would be a period, and it's only a period, where we might end up with a two-tier system, where some pharmacies won't have a prescriber and some pharmacies will. but it's with the knowledge or the goal to get everyone so that we don't have a two-tier system. But it might, we might have to accept an uncomfortable couple of years. I mean uncomfortable is that we might have a different level of service across until we actually get there.
Mm-hmm. No, I think I admire your, I think that's the nub of your leadership actually over recent years, is my observation anyway. I think you probably took a risk in that mm-hmm. direction of travel. And it was partly probably supported by, you know, prescription for excellence and so on and so forth. And to be fair, some of the ideas of Bill Scott previously, right, yep. medicine and all that. And the community pharmacy network will probably batter me here, but they would tend to be a conservative bunch. So, and that's because they're like me, they're a business owner. So, you know, if you're doing okay in the status quo, you really don't want anything to change. So I respect how you've gone out on a limb and taking a risk to lead them, and I think they're coming with you, and that is wonderful to see. So
to be fair though, Jonathan, that I am given the privilege of being able to advocate what the pharmacy owners in Scotland have asked for. So I can input and try and influence that view, but actually what comes out in delivery is the owners themselves saying, I've been fortunate as well to be given the opportunity to let Matt, this sounds a terrible phrase, but let Matt deal with today and allow me to look to tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So as an organisation that has been around for over 100 years now, I didn't want to be the chief exec that brought it to an end or didn't make sure it was available for the next 100 years. So as I say, we tried very much to keep an eye on what is the future going to be? So 3 years ago, the board was good enough to say, yeah, we should be looking at prescribing. And it's taken that length of time to almost get us to a position where we can actually move into implementation. Mm-hmm. But when you look back and think, well, I've been here 14 years already, that over a three-year period, you go, well, I'd take that. And if in 3 years' time I'm in a position to say 50% of the network has a prescriber in it, would be a real success. And then 3 years after that, you know, 3 years after that, if I could say, we're at 70% now. And suddenly you've got a momentum that becomes the norm. So I suppose the one thing I would say, Jonathan, I've got the power of the conviction behind it. And I think it's right. And having the experience in the community, knowing sometimes the frustration even myself I dealt with by saying, see if I could just have written that script. The patient here would just have been so much better.
And I think I get it as well. And I think you've cleverly preempted my next question. I mean, I was going to ask about workforce, but workforce is going to sort itself out. You know, if the youngsters coming out have got the prospect potentially in the future of a community pharmacy foundation type program, moving into supervised, you know, experiential learning, hopefully during their undergraduate years, moving into you know, gathering data, gathering information, we'll understand where the gaps are, we'll be able to refine our product. When I say product, I mean the community pharmacy offering. Yeah. And then eventually, you know, I'd like to see you know, training practices, training community pharmacy practices, that type of thing. Yep. You know, it all fits. I get it, and I think a lot of people get it, but doing it is a different matter. And I go back to that point about the strategy. So do nothing, and you know, supply just isn't enough anymore, because Amazon can do that, and yep. and they're looking for their trademark and pharmacy and all the rest of it. We know all that, but this is real added value. And you've preempted my next question about workforce, because if this comes off or even begins to start to come off, I do think the youngsters will be getting they're already a lot more excited about community and. You know, it's a much more interesting prospect, really.
And what you need to dovetail with that, Jonathan, is the service that the pharmacy network can then deliver. So the advice of pharmacy first, the opportunity to use your prescribing skills, using the whole wide community pharmacy team to do the tech bit, because the vision of Community Pharmacy Scotland, or the board that did put out, also stated that actually separate the pharmacist for that, not from their responsibility for it or their accountability for it, but for their user skill in the area that they're really trained in.
Absolutely.
And that's where I can see, you know, coming back to the community, ideally of the terrible phrase, but the linchpin of the pharmacist. And I was given a piece of advice very early in my career that said, you get the staff you deserve. Mm-hmm. So if your staff don't quite do or are not trained to the level that you think they should be, then you need to have a look at yourself first. Because actually, if that is what you desire and you need to run your operation, then what are you doing to put that in place? Because ultimately, use your skill to deliver the care that we need and that I'm trying to advocate in 10 years' time where we might be. Mm-hmm. So I very much hope we turn this into a vision of, because 30 years ago when I started, community was a place to be. And I still believe that, but I'd like to make it more transparent for people to go, actually, I really put my degree and my care to in the community in there. There's the environment, there's the service that allows me to do it. I want a piece of that.
So, absolutely. And I'm gonna go even more into the future before I'm gonna drag you back to politics. Unfortunately. It's never too far away. But I like that whole pharmacy first thing. I think it's gonna flourish and all the rest of it. One bit I personally believe is important, though, is that I think we need to understand what happens to the medicine beyond the dispensing bench, actually. Mm-hmm. And I know that that is blue sky thinking, but mm-hmm. And I think pharmaceutical care isn't dead, actually. I think it could get a second airing. But I'll just leave that hanging. Now back to politics.
You could start me in pharmacogenomics and what, but that's maybe a topic for another day, Jonathan. But there we go.
We'll start talking about technoceutical care, Harry. That's
another phrase. I believe you used it. Aye, very
that's
good.
Invent the word and then make it up after that. Anyway, so politics, supply and demand of medicines report. Now, I don't know where to start. I think I can say this, and I wouldn't expect you to say this. I think I'm going to sort of summarize my thoughts on it. So look, reading that report, initially I thought, oh yes, saying a lot of good things, but dig a bit deeper and you think, right, academic rigor, areas it looks at, the tone of the language, the timing. Was that a complete waste of time?
I think, like I say, Jonathan, there's one or two nuggets in it, but you got to look hard for them. There was things there. One of the things I would say in the language with it, if our colleagues have read it, it will say the committee was surprised by it. You know, it mentions that a few times, and you go, well, what surprised you about it? Because I'm normally surprised when I have one opinion and somebody else comes up with another one. And despite colleagues who presented to that particular committee, which then made its way into the report, all saying the same thing, the committee were still surprised, which maybe indicates to me on a personal basis that they might have had a view even before they took the evidence. Well, so, you know, I was like, well, why are you surprised when four or five expert bodies that spoke to them gave them the same opinion, but yet they said, no, you should go away and have a look at it? Yeah. So there's some things I'm sure that won't get taken up. There are others we need to have a look at. It mentions around elements of what we do with supply. What is the value? I think it was, if I'm right, Jonathan, they placed on the value of what medicines we've been taking and what best use are we getting out of that. And that maybe takes us to your view about what happens beyond the supply and the dispensing. And I could, you might, or another time we might talk about what that means in terms of patient-generated data, mm-hmm. what that might do for the profession going forward. But, so if colleagues want to have a look at the report, they can. I think there's a couple of nuggets in it. There are some other bits that I don't put much store on, and there's some that are just misunderstood. But We did our best during our evidence sessions to make sure that didn't happen.
Well, as you know, I tried to, I did my best with my amateur editor's hat on and found some positivity in there. I think it furthered our argument a wee bit about access to records, and I think what they said about data and as you say, understanding what happens to the medicine after it leaves the dispensary. We as a profession need to understand how we fit with that actually. That was good, but there were other bits I did raise an eyebrow.
Yeah,
probably like yourself.
I'm sure there'll be a government response. The government will respond to that, to the committee itself. I'd be very surprised if other bodies don't. We'll certainly, as you know, Matt and the team have poured through it and got some pointers for us that we'll have a look at. But in the main, the network itself didn't come out too badly out of it. Mm-hmm. There are other bits in where pointed that it makes a reference certainly to CPS's leadership and whatever, and you go, better have a look at that. But internally we'll do that, yeah.
I think it's interesting. I don't want to labour this point because it's probably, to be honest, not worth the airtime, but and I could say that. But I thought the response from you and Johnny B at the RPS, well, I think it was Matt actually put the quote across. So it was quite a measured, diplomatic as ever, sort of straight bat, if we're using a cricketing term. Yeah. Now compare that with the BMA and Andrew Boost and stuff like that. And I mean, they were just upset. I think any mention of Quaff and they get very upset. But it just occurred to me that, I mean, the reason I raise that is we're at the total other end of the spectrum, aren't we, in pharmacy? So we would crave any way to gather information and record stuff, wouldn't we? So, it's like everything. There's a happy medium, I guess. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
But I think what it does show is that across the spectrum of people involved in the medicine supply procurement, as it goes across, actually, we need to have a much more joined up approach about who's responsible and where it lies. And if anything comes out of that report that facilitates good sharing of data, clear definitions of who does what, but without it being in a silo. Mm-hmm. So it's not about separating out you there, you here, and never the two shall meet. It's how does that continuum pass across with information, etc. And that whole supply bit. And that's where I think the report doesn't quite pick up on that, Jonathan. It still, for me, keeps it a wee bit, that's you here and that's you here. And I've spoken to Andrew since the publication of the report about what it is and what does it mean for electronic prescribing, repeat script management, all of that type of thing going forward. And I'll be very surprised if we don't end up talking about that again.
That's politics. A couple of questions left because you've been very generous with your time, Harry. I really do appreciate that. One's I want to ask you as a person and as a pharmacist, not as so here's a disclaimer. I want to ask this question as a individual, Harry McQuillan, rather than CPS CEO. So one of my, and I suppose it is a wee bit political, but it's professional and political. So the lie of the land in terms of professional representation and that whole scene in pharmacy has changed dramatically since, basically, I think, since the GPA, the RPS-GB split, isn't it?
Yes.
And then of course, RPS popped up about 8 years ago, 9 years ago. GPHC was formed and on we go, and there's been various ebbs and flows of both organizations and so on and so forth. But my observation, as a commentator now, I guess I am, and I don't know whether this is social media driven or whether it's, you know, it's better use of or more effective use of the internet, shall we say. But lots and lots, there just seems to be millions of organizations cropping up.
Yeah.
PCPA. I mean, there's. I think I asked the question on Twitter one night, and there's about, you know, there were about 25 answers.
Yeah.
Which is fine. So I think that personally, I think that says something. It's up to readers and listeners to say what.
Mm-hmm.
But the premise to the question is the growth, particularly in the union. So the PDA, I mean, and this is a very up-to-date sort of fact, PDA had their AGM this year, and I was quite surprised, well, not surprised, but I was, it was notable that they now are reporting more than 30,000 members.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think of, you know, when you think of how many pharmacists are on the register, that's a fair amount. So
yep.
After this long introduction, Harry, the question is, do you think the unionization of pharmacy as a profession is a good thing?
For me, I struggle with why we would need it. And this is, as you've asked me for a personal opinion, in that I've never felt the need as a registered healthcare professional to join the union, because I'm responsible for my own decisions, my behaviour, and accountable to that. If I have an employer that doesn't support me in my view or my conditions that I do, then I don't think I would be there. As I maybe mentioned before, as somebody who's nearing the twilight of his career, it's easy to say that when you're young and enthusiastic, and well, hopefully I'm still enthusiastic, I'm just not young anymore, but as you move to keep your career going, I can understand how it's not so easy just to move with family or personal commitments. But what is it that's missing that a union is filling? So for other organisations who were there long before some of the unions that you mentioned, what are they not doing? What is the hole that's being filled? Is it representation? Is it working conditions? Is it advocacy? And what is it that used to be provided? I have to say through one body, because it was a regulator and a professional body, and you were, whether we like it or not, mandated to be a member if you wanted to practice. What changed for the profession when that was split? And what didn't happen? And for me, I've never felt the need for someone else to fill the gap. But I would have to say, I don't think there's any doubt, Jonathan, that other members feel as though there is a gap. And therefore, some of the unions have filled it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I'm going back to that period about, well, what is it that was missing that allowed that to happen? Sorry, allowed's wrong. Made it happen rather than allowed. What was it that membership didn't get? Was it representation? Was it, you know, and equally, I can understand why that's difficult for a professional body. So that's my view. Is it a good thing? It seems to give a sense in the profession of non-unity, and I'm not so convinced that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. So there's my personal opinion.
Yeah, no, it's interesting, and I think it's worthy of discussion. And I don't hear much discussion about that actually in the profession. I think what I see is organisations trying to sort of hit their own key performance indicators, be that members, you know, coverage if they're a publisher. But as I speak to you today, like, you're a pharmacist, I'm a pharmacist with different backgrounds, but that is the thread,
yes,
that kind of draws us together, isn't it? And I don't know, I just simplify it down. I think it's tough out there. You know, we need to feel, as pharmacists, we need, when we're making these difficult decisions, especially recently, I think we need to feel like, not that someone's got your back, but that you're part of a collective.
Yeah.
And actually, what that collective means, in my opinion, really needs to be looked at and really defined so that we feel more comfortable. And then I would hope, if we feel comfortable, then we move forward.
Yeah.
But at the minute, it just feels like we're, just a personal view, Harry, but we're playing to avoid defeat maybe a wee bit. It's just a subtle.
It does.
Difference.
Yep. Do you play to win, or do you, as you say, do you play to win, or do you play to avoid defeat?
Mm-hmm.
And I think, yeah, it is an interesting debate, Jonathan, an interesting kind of point you raise. I would say to you as well, the whole title thing, where am I going with this? I see myself as a pharmacist. I gave you a very potted history of a career when I started with. But that one title, sorry, that one word, let's not use the word title, that one word pharmacist has allowed me to do it all. Mm-hmm. So I've never said I'm a community pharmacist, I'm a hospital pharmacist, I'm primary care, or I'm a clinical blah 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 pharmacist. Actually, I'm a pharmacist who at this point in my career is working in the political sphere, and I've got exactly the same degree as the person who's working in primary care, who's working in the community, who's working in secondary care, who's working in industry. I'm drawing on the expertise of my degree to allow me to operate in this sector at this particular time. And I, if I had a concern for the profession at the minute, we appear to be more concerned with roles than profession. And I mean by roles, we rely on titles rather than what we actually do in them. And I would like to see that focus flipped to actually, what do you deliver? What do you do? What does it mean? And what I mean by a role is, so for instance, I think my role is to provide an infrastructure and a network and funding process that allows people, pharmacists in the community, to deliver care on behalf of patients. That's my role. My title is chief exec. Mm-hmm. And you see the subtlety of difference there.
Absolutely.
I would like us to be talking about, if I describe my role, I don't tell you my title, I tell you why I'm there. Perfect. And I think that's one of the things I think the profession could have a look at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right, let's finish, because you've been, as I said, very generous with your time. Final question. Ask this of let's say more experienced pharmacists in the profession. How about that? Is that, can I get away with that? What's your advice to the youngsters coming through? You know, young pharmacists that are coming onto the register.
My advice would be, accept the responsibility that comes with it. I've mentioned to you, people giving me advice all throughout my career, and I remember asking a pharmacist while I was a student, why do you always, you seem to do emergency supplies and you intervene, and I see other pharmacists coming to do relief and they don't send people back for a script. And he actually said, I've been given a privilege to practice in this manner by the laws and the ethics that define my profession. And it's a privilege to do it. And I've never forgotten that. And so all the youngsters that's coming on, your profession and your career will be what you make it. And you have the authority to act as a professional, and I really encourage you to use it. I would say hopefully some of the things I've laid out, I'm keen to see delivered, particularly for the community sector, and how that then fits with colleagues in primary care and secondary care as that goes on, to come on board with that. And I think there is a bright future for you if you want to take it.
Very good. Perfect.
Don't rely on old bods like me. Shape the future yourselves.
Very good. Hopefully
I'll give you the platform to allow you to practice. But get involved and make it where you want it to be.
That's very good. And I think it's helpful, for pharmacists of your level of experience to give permission to the next generation as well. You know, they are, things change so quickly and time moves on. It's up to them.
Somebody was good enough, Jonathan, has given it to me. I just see my role of passing it on.
Brilliant. That is a perfect way to finish.
Thanks, Jonathan.
I'm going to leave it there. It's been great. Thank you very much, Harry. Yeah, really good. We'll be, I'm going to get this date wrong, but it's the end of July. Is it the 29th of July, Pharmacy First Launches?
29th. Yep.
Very good. We'll be looking out for that, and I'm sure everyone wishes the network all the best with that.
Yep, great. Thanks, Jonathan.
Cheers. Chatting. All the best.